Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Välkommen till en ny episode av ukens vintips. Idag har vi också en engelsktalig gäst. Hon är mastersommelier, utdannet i 2010. Hon har ingående kännskap om landet hon nästan representerar, men också från en av de tonagivande, viktiga producenterna som har tagit Norge med storm. Och vi ska snacka om engelskmuseerna. Vi må slå över på engelsk. Welcome, Laura, to our podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
We have invited you to the podcast because of a blind tasting who happened on the Sommelier Day in Norway for some couple of weeks ago, where 30 Norwegian sommeliers tasted 10 different sparkling wines, of some English and some champagne, and the winner was Gospel.
Yes.
And we will talk about what the reason is behind it. Mm-hmm. That it was a blind tasting where nothing was set up. Mm-hmm. It was just blind, and many sommeliers said, "Wow, how is possible to get that quality?" You know, as master sommelier, why? I know as a wine journalist why this happened. But please explain me, what is the benefit to drink Gospel, except from the alcohol?
Okay, well. So, yes, Gospel, English sparkling wine, has found a new level, a new renaissance recently, I think. We look at the industry now versus where it was 20, 30 years ago, and it's wonderful to look at what's happening with the industry as a whole. Gospel, we have always wanted to make world-class sparkling wines, and since we started, everything we've done has really been about how we can produce the very best wines possible. So, we grow all of our own grapes. We don't buy or sell any fruit, and we, you know, focus very much on vintage only wines, so single vintage wines. But the blending process itself is really, you know, really unique, very in depth, and we like to age our wines for longer on lees as well.
Because the aging part of Gospel is something special, because you don't have non-vintage, you have vintage.
Right.
And all from the beginning.
Yes.
And when we are talking of beginning, it has to be a little bit clearance, because the Gospel property have is from 1410 or the name or the yes. Could you just take me a little bit back to the 1410? Why the name and so on?
Mm-hmm. So we bought the estate in 2004. Gospel estate. Mm. And the estate itself, the land dates back to the 1400s. Well, it dates back much further than that. But as far as we can find it, in the 1400s, it was owned by a gentleman called John de Gusborn.
That's the reason.
Estate. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And over the years, it went from Gusborn to Gosborn to Gusborn.
Ah.
So we bought the land as Gusborn Estate. And at the time, it was arable land. So there was crops and vegetables and things planted there. And so then we planted the first vineyards in 2004, 5 and 6 and 7, and then added a little bit more land in 14 and 15 as well.
Yeah.
And then we also have land in Sussex. Yeah. So...
Because originally it was just a father who was coming to visit his daughter, and then suddenly have a good idea and have some money, and then he invested.
Yeah.
So exactly. It's not a well planned reason behind it. It was just, okay, this is possible to do, we try.
Yeah, there was a lot of planning behind it as well. Mm. So our founder, Yes, he was coming to visit his daughter who lived in the village and saw the land and really understood the potential, I think, for it. And then there was a lot of soil surveys and exploration, I think, beforehand. But also he was South African, or he is South African, and had been involved a little bit in the industry in South Africa as well. And
in the wine industry?
Yeah, just a little bit. Not as a producer or anything like that. But
by drinking?
Well, drinking as well, but various bits and pieces. And I think he kind of saw what happened in South Africa and then could kind of start to see what was happening in the UK in the late 90s and early 2000s. Yeah. Of course, the landscape of the industry was entirely different to what we see now. But really saw the potential, I think, for making some amazing wines. So.
I remember the first wines, since Norway is the biggest export country for England for the time being, with a lot of brands. Mm-hmm. More or less everyone who is important is in Norway present with importers. There are many different styles and age of producers, and not everyone is very good, but some is standing out as fantastic good. Yeah. But at that time, in 2007, we tasted the first bottle who was arrived to Norway, including the Gospel who was arriving. I don't think it was imported, but I think it was just sent over just to try, you Norwegian guys. Yeah. But at that time, I remember that in my notes from that time, I was writing, sure, this is tasting acidic, it's not good. You know, I didn't know anything about the English sparkling. I was wrong, really wrong, because it from 2007 until today, it had been a fantastic journey for English sparkling. But could you explain us or for the listeners from the inside, from you started to when you first heard about it? You take your master sommelier in 2010, and probably a little bit before you start drinking and learning about wine. How was to be in England and seeing this? Because this is as a start of champagne. If you are thinking not a bigger scale, but it's a start of a new industry.
Sure.
Really start, because if you see on buildings the producers have today, it's not big chateaus and except from someone, but it's small producers. They are not 300 million bottles a year or it's, you know, it's small. It's, you know, each other, everyone.
Yeah.
If you go to London, you have to explain the waiter who's English, what sparkling from England are. They don't know of every brand.
Well,
many sommeliers, of course, do. But often when I've been in London, and we have the same thing with Norwegian akevitt. We have a huge amount of Norwegian akevitt.
Yeah.
But Norwegian waiters, and they don't just know about maybe 10 brands. Mm-hmm. That's the same effort. But please tell me your first impression of English sparkling from the inside and out.
Well, so I started as a sommelier in 2004, and I was an English sommelier with a team full of French sommeliers, which is very normal at the time in the UK. You know, there were a lot of French, Italian sommeliers, not a huge amount of English sommeliers. Where I was working at the time has a few English sparkling wines on the list. And I remember being very fiercely patriotic about these wines. And it was Ridgeview, Knightimber and Chapel Down. And I would speak to guests and say, would you like to try something English and sparkling? And the guests would say to me, no, I'm not sure. Or they'd say, really? We make wine in England? And so there was, you know, there was a little bit of hesitancy, certainly. And I think then I can remember, it must have been about 2008, maybe nine. And I was working with Gérard Basset at the time at his hotel. And
a fantastic man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A real legend and a real loss.
Yes.
But he was, you know, a wonderful man and a great inspiration. And so I was his head sommelier at his hotel for a little while. And he was very supportive. And I remember saying to him, oh, I would love to have an English wine list, like a page. And he said,
own page.
Yeah. And he said, well, okay, sure, if you can, then go ahead. You know, that was very much his ethos. And so there I was trying to pick these wines and, you know, trying to find smaller producers. And at the time, the industry was, you know, so different, and and they didn't have distribution in many ways.
The logistic was wrong, and information, they didn't have internet sites, they didn't have brand managers, everything was just, we make it, okay.
Yeah, and exactly, you know, and in many respects, as many emerging regions are. But, so I made this wine list, and I think I had this kind of, you know, make it and they will come kind of attitude. And actually people really enjoyed the wines and there was a little bit less skepticism. And then, you know, fast forward a bit more and I was working in a Michelin star restaurant in London and had tasted Gusborne, finally. This was in 2013, 14. Loved the wines. You know, I think there was something different about them in many respects. And so we started listing them by the glass. And I wanted to take champagne off and have only English sparkling wines by the glass. And it was felt that that was maybe a bit too far. That was that was a step too far. So I didn't do that. But what was interesting is that people were starting to come and ask for a glass of champagne or ask for a glass of Gusborne. Yeah. And we were in a restaurant where...
So Gusborne become a brand name like IBM and Xerox. Meaning sparkling from England?
I mean Gusborne. I think Gusborne became just a glass of Gusborne. It was never. Yeah. It was never anything other than that. But yeah, I think people were starting to say, "Oh, well, actually, English sparkling wine is quite tasty. This is interesting." Yeah. And then, you know, funnily enough, I remember. So I joined Gusborne in 2015. And I remember even before I joined, and I said to a couple of friends, "Do you know what? I've had 20 great years working in restaurants, but I think now's the time to think about something different. I want to try something different. I love English wines and I've always been very passionate about the industry. And, you know, it was pretty difficult in 2004 to be, you know, so passionate about it. But I could see, you know, I could see this evolution.
It's coming, and people after you, you know, you can see that,
okay. Yeah, you know, and I could see, you know, some serious potential within the industry. But even then, people said, sure.
But do you remember some numbers around this? Because I read somewhere that it had been the goal for 2030 is a goal, how many bottles who should be produced from England. That's a common goal. I think it's around 30 million bottles.
Something like that. Yeah.
And you see the champagne industry have 400 million bottles a year. So it will never be the same thing. If not, France is inviting England again. I don't know. But many, many years ago, they were connected. The distance between Champagne and England, the first, are 144 kilometers in. So it's not far.
No.
If you have a fast plane or can fly, but it takes a long time to drive.
It does.
But from your point of view, or also maybe for mine, Gusborne Special 2004 and up to 2010-11, then it changed. Then it was more precise. Then it were more. You know, have you heard about that before? That it had been the first beginning of years, it had been maybe lack of tasting experience from us, but then suddenly I see my notes is going over 88, 89, 90 points. Have you heard about that change?
Or for maybe English later? Sparkling wine generally?
Yeah. No, for Gusborne.
Well, Gusborne, we released...
Because they're stepping up quality over time. So from 2013-15, it had been stable like rock. But the first couple of years, it had been a little bit down, it had been some oxidation, it had been something in my tasting notes. Yeah. And I've read also others that, had there been a learning process for everyone to start to... Yeah. To make wine, it's just once a year.
Exactly. Yeah. So our first vintage was 2006, and we released those wines in 2010.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we have so few bottles of those early vintages left that it's hard to ever go back and retaste them. I remember the 07s being delicious, and I remember, you know, but you're right. I think it's like anything, isn't it? Yeah. We started with just a few hectares of land. Mm. And, you know, we planted a Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Pinot Meunier, and I think those few hectares grew over the years. But yes, I think if you look now where we are as a producer versus probably the wines we were producing in those first years, there's a definite shift in terms of style.
And why I ask is because Champagne have over 300 years with history. And now you're beating them in contest with 30 sommeliers in Norway. And also winning a lot of prizes. Just in 2021, you have over 60 prizes, international good-looking mm-hmm. awards.
Yeah.
I mean, you're beating champagne, Gospel, and that's fantastic. I have an idea that some of the, and we're going to taste the wines, we have brought to the studio the Blanc de Blanc 2018.
Yep.
And then we have the second winner at the competition, the Grange,
yep.
that we don't know so much about, but it took the second prize. Yep. And we will have a short description of this, but we're going to have a focus on the Blanc de Blanc. But could you just give us a little bit update? You know, the name Champagne is well known. The Sect, Prosecco, all these names for the... How and what name have English Sparkling become? What do you call it? It's official now? It's something?
It's still English Sparkling at the moment.
English Sparkling at the moment.
Yeah, I think we'll see what happens. There's something called the Great British Classic Method.
Yes. Oh, the Great British Method?
Great British Classic method, which has been, you know, floated and discussed, and there's a logo and all that kind of thing, but you know, it still needs to be adopted
and
at
just
the same
for,
time
for
well,
updating so. Your listener who what we are talking about now is that the English industry have not decided what to have the official name as champagne or in France or in Prosecco in Italy. They are on the path, so this is a so young industry that the official parts of it is not in place yet,
right?
And in Champagne, in Chablis, in many others countries, like for instance Chablis, it was from 1912 to 1936. It was a discussion where the boundaries should be, and all this, and that's cleared in England. That could you place make sparkling anywhere? It's no official. No.
Anywhere in England and Wales.
Okay. So that probably will come, hopefully. But it didn't happen at day one in Champagne either.
Of course.
No. You know. So this is just so new. So that's, for me, as a wine journalist who love and have experienced from the beginning, I think this is a fantastic moment, because I didn't expect, I was not there when Champagne was made over the 50 years, first years.
Yeah.
But I read a little bit about Gospin up through the years, but one of the things I've been into the cloning thing with the grapes, and we are going a little bit technical, but usually many of the producers of English Sparkling are taking clones from Champagne. But you have taken from Burgundy, somewhere else. Do you know anything about the reason why and how?
So, yes. When we first planted those first varieties, we had Burgundian clones and Champagne clones.
Hmm.
And we planted our vineyards in different years and quite systematically in that sense. And I think some of the clonal decisions came from soil analysis. Some of the clonal decisions came from the fact that we wanted lower yields, and Burgundian clones tend to yield lower than Champagne clones. And, you know, when you look at our environment and you look at the climate, it made a lot of sense to have lower yielding vines so that we'd get more intensity, more concentration, more weight. And actually that's really happened, especially in Kent. We have a lot of clay and sand soils, and the Burgundian clones really thrive there. And then in Sussex, we have chalk and flint, and we have a mixture of both those kind of clones too. But we have altogether 41 different clones planted in different areas of our
And just to update the listeners and so on, clones are in kind of same family, but they have the same Chardonnay name, but it's different numbers afterwards, and they are doing different stuff or making different use.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they will all be Chardonnay, for example, or Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, but a different clone might react differently to a different soil type or to a different climate as well. And so that's why you have clones that thrive in different
areas.
And just
one a little bit alone with that kind of mostly Burgundy, or it's just been...
Yeah, there are a few other producers, but no, it's, yes. Okay. I think there's a lot more Champagne clones, I think, than Burgundian clones, generally speaking.
Gospin have won a lot of prizes, but it's the only winery who have won the best English winery 3 times. And that's because you're new, have vintage, and are a little bit premium style, because everyone else is making just non-vintage or more simpler wine, not everyone, but you are focused on the vintage. And of course, when you taste a vintage, it's different than a non-vintage. Is that because you have a lot of, you're winning a lot of competition. And we see that not so many are of the smaller producers from England are included in that tastings. So Gospen is a bit ahead of marketing. It's very good. And the marketing of Gospen, are there any from Champagne working in the Gospen from Champagne industry in marketing? How many are you? How many employed are you in? How big is Gospen?
Gosh, altogether we must have, including the guys in the vineyard, the winery, the office team, the sales team, marketing, 45, maybe?
Yeah, it's a decent scale, 50. Around 30, then you lose control of who we're working or not, so that's normal.
And we have different sites as well. We have people in Sussex, we have people in Kent, and then obviously the sales team are not based at the winery, but they're a little bit further.
But also the sales team and how you build up the industry have also boomed, and it invested a lot of money to bigger wineries. Today, Gospen is having 140 plus hectares. And you started with 20 around.
We have 90 hectares.
90 hectares.
90 hectares. We're
going to taste the Grange first. It's coming from Hampshire. It's rosé. What you said? It's better to drink in the podcast. So. From the early tastings. 2007 until today is one thing I mark with everyone is that they have a very marked acidity, all of them, and it's very clean, fresh, and this have a little bit red apple content in it, but the bubbles are small. It is a little bit the fruit is not complete in the mouth, but it's a decent quality. And easily compared to a champagne. What is your point of view of this champagne? Or this sparkling, I mean.
pardon me. So I really enjoyed this wine. I think, as you say, you know, it's very fruit forward. There's lots of that really kind of bright but very elegant red fruit character coming through. And that really nice kind of fresh acidity, but green apple, red apple notes. I think there's a real freshness and energy, I think, in this wine. I think it's, for me, I think it's delicious.
Yeah. But. If you have, go back to the restaurant stage and would place a recipe to this this wine, what have you chosen? And remember, do not take English special courses including a little bit international so people understand what it is. But, but what is the, what do you use the acidity in this wine to food?
You know, I would use it with a fish like salmon, for example. So something that's a little bit oily, a little bit fatty, or tuna. Seafood, I think, just works beautifully with wines like this. Prawns and shrimp. Because, you know, if you get one of those, like those beautiful kind of open shrimp sandwiches when the shrimp is really sweet and delicate, something like that. Anything that has a little bit of either fattiness that then the acidity can cut through.
Like butter or oil or something like that.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. But then also something where the flavors are quite delicate, especially for something like this rosé, which is a really delicate, very light, very very elegant style of rosé, I think.
Now, after the competition for some weeks ago, I was having the numbers in front before everyone knew. So I think, what? Again? Because Steven Spurrier had a tasting for some years ago, and it was the same result. Two sparkling from England won the competition, and again, it was coming up. And we're not going to name the other champagne brands, but it's famous, very old, many hundred years old, and they are making good wine. And in this category, we are not talking about commercial brands. We are talking about small producers who is high-end, but it's kind of, what is the difference between English sparkling and champagne? and to well train. And many of the sommeliers attending to that class was the best in Europe of tasting wines. So it was, this is good. But let us go to the Blanc de Blanc. I don't know. You have certain qualities, of course, of the wines. But what is selling most of the wines you have in the portfolio? Is the Blanc de Blanc, or it's...
Yeah, probably is the Blanc de Blanc, actually.
Not
yeah,
in Norway, but in general.
In general, in general, you know, the Blanc de Blanc is our flagship, if you like. It's our best expression of Chardonnay. It's the wine we use to really kind of celebrate Chardonnay and what it brings from the vineyards. So,
Let us test. And I will start the tasting. For me, Gosman is a favorite. I've been for maybe 3-4 years. It have changed to more open fruit. The acidity is still there, but in this is lighter than the Grange, as we tasted before. But the palate is more more including. So it's the acidity is there. It's easy drinking. I prefer it in a bigger glass if I drink it just without food. The wine are long lasting, so it will be there for a very long time. So this reminds me of a Blanc de Blanc, of course, from Champagne, but also from Germany in some cases. The wine, I see Gosman as a reference to Blanc de Blanc outside Champagne, but not compared often, because it's fruit-driven together with acidity. So in Champagne, often very acidity, but not so much fruit. And in early tasting notes from the 50s and 60s, from the biggest wine journalists and best tasters, they are, in Champagne, have the same tasting notes that we have today in England. So they are mentioning fruit, they are mentioning acidity, but today they're not mentioning fruit in Champagne in many cases. What is the main reason why the climate have changed so much? Towards to that England can produce that kind of quality, because it having about how many days?
Right.
And please tell us about the days.
So there's a perceived wisdom, I think, that the ideal length of growing season, so from the moment of flowering to the moment of harvest, that should be about 100 days. And so 100 days gives the fruit, the grapes, the ability to ripen, to ripen in terms of acid falling and sugar rising, but also rather crucially in terms of phenolic ripeness. And when we talk about phenolic ripeness, that's where we talk about flavor development. And so it's more than just the kind of the levels of acid and sugar. It's more about where you find those fruit flavors developing and the compounds for those. What happens is if a growing area is quite warm, for example, then the acid starts to drop. And crucially, when we make traditional method sparkling wines, because of the methods that, you know, the second fermentation in bottle and the lees aging, because of that, you need to have high acidity in those original grapes. And so then I suppose there's that balance between making sure that the acid's not too low, but that the ripeness is full enough. And I think in the UK at the moment, we are in that sweet spot.
Is it 90 or 110 days? Or
it's about 100.
Yeah,
it's about 100.
So if we go back 20 years, you didn't have 100 days. So it was
it would have been even longer, I think. Well, the reality is if you go back 30 years or so, actually, you just couldn't have got the ripeness. And we see it even now. You know, we see at Gusborn that we are harvesting more often in September now than we were 20 years ago. So there is a shift. But not always. Yeah. Of course, you still have years like last year, which was very cool. And it was a very challenging year and it was a late harvest. But some of those base wines that were created from that year were really interesting as well. And so, you know, I think what's really fascinating about producing English sparkling wine is that, you know, blending process in terms of finding all those different blocks. And, you know, we end up with, 300.
Because the distance between wine yards are quite long. So you don't have it next to each other. You have many plots in the hectares you have, the 90 hectares. They are not at the same spot?
Well, they're fairly, well, no, they're not in the same spot. No. So we have two estates.
Yeah.
One is in Kent and then one is in Sussex.
And the distance is there in kilometres or miles?
It's about 100 kilometres.
Yes.
Something like that.
You don't run that a day, I think. No.
No.
Okay, but that's the distance. But it's a huge difference in expression of the
yes.
And that's is that one of the main factors that Gospon is achieving something that it have?
Yeah, I think
positive
so.
Positive part of it. Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm not too sure because we both have been in Champagne many times, we are traveling around.
Yeah.
England is a kind of there are no natural source for truth. It is a young industry, so people really don't know. And some questions are not answered yet because we don't have history for 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And there are not so many vintage sparkling, but we can see through the tastings of blind tasting that people love this and thinking, okay, but it's the acidity who they love, the difference, or is the pure quality of concentration? I think it's the concentration of fruit that is just present. And also the knowledge that I see of New Timber and others, that they have a knowledge of tasting wide of good. They're not making a copycat of champagne, but they're making their own, but they know what they do, and they do it faster. Uh-huh. They are a little bit on the table too. To organize quality and also building up industry to grow fast. So they know how, like 400 years ago in Champagne, it was a family. They take step for step, pay the bill, step. But here is, okay, we invest 10 million euros and then we invest in things and then we're getting the result much faster. Mm-hmm. So it's going, and we know the potential of sale. And that leads to my next question. In Norway, the sparkling are well priced. The Gospon is well priced, around 400 kroner. Some of them are 550. It's coming up to 600. But it's always in the same level of champagne, and sometimes a little bit higher. Could you explain me a little bit of the policy in general? Why sparkling are that priced, and how? Why?
Yeah, sure. Well. In many respects, it's the reality in terms of how much it costs to produce the wine, you know, in terms of lees aging, in terms of the land as well. We think about Champagne, for example. They have kind of economies of scale, perhaps, that the UK doesn't have as a small, young industry. That brings with us a lot of positives, but it also brings negatives in terms of, yes, you know, it costs quite a lot to plant a vineyard. And then you have to wait 6 years before you can sell the first bottle. So, you know, there's a lot of investment cost there as well. And also when you think about the lees aging and the amount generally it costs to make a bottle of wine. And, you know, these wines are made in exactly the same way as champagne. Vintage wines aged for as long as a champagne would be, and so in many respects, qualitatively speaking, and we've seen this with various tastings and this particular tasting that we're talking about. You know, qualitatively, I think we can say that the wines are on a par, and stylistically they are similar, but they have their own character as well. And so I think then it makes sense that these wines are on a par in terms of pricing as well. I think, you know, 10 years ago, it was more difficult to explain that to people because you had to physically get the wine into people's glasses so that they understood
the quality, of price.
The quality and they understood the style and they understood the price. And, you know, and things are changing, things are shifting.
I have some discussion often with people that why should I pay so much for English sparkling when I have a champagne with the brand I know for many decades.
Yeah.
And I used to explain them, okay, this is the reason they are smaller. They have expenses in the same way. But do you think that when probably, I'm not too sure, but this is in a positive way we can see in 10 years' time, we will probably have so much more producers, but they are coming, popping up like, I don't know, like gamblings. A lot of small producers, two people who have some experience going back, making good quality, they are working together, they are on social media, they are making brands in garages, in buying. It's fun to see. And it's half an hour from London. It's so fun. But do you think that when the production is going up, the prices will level out, because we don't have a English parking over 1,000 krona or 100 euros yet, but it probably will come. Do you have any secrets from Gazprom who is coming in the cellar? You can't tell me, but I can see your eyes that maybe something is coming. Okay. Then we are looking forward to have that. Please send a bottle or make me to buy one. Because what I'm missing now is the prestige cuvée, you know, the prestige thing. Yeah. And I'm thinking of this for some while now, and I think in 5-6 years, you have it in the cellar, and then mm-hmm. in 5-6 years, it's coming some releases who show the potential of, my personal favorite of champagne is Krug. Yeah. Everyone knows that. I love Krug.
Who doesn't? I love it too.
Thank you. Then we are friends. But at that time, in the same way, some producers need to go step up and making prestige cuvées. So it could be smaller, but just showing what the potential are. And that takes time, of course.
It does.
But you are probably one of them who have project going on. But is this something you discuss inside the business to work up quality over time? As for instance, I was visiting Sancerre last week.
Yeah.
And Sancerre, after my opinion, have one problem. They don't have the Grand Cris, Premier Cris, and today there are no official or standard of quality of prestige cuvée. It's a kind of the producer's name and reputation, and then going on. Yeah. But in 50, 100 years time, English sparkling industry could be 5-double, 6-double, 100 times bigger if it's needed, because the rules are not set yet. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is important to work with now, that kind of thought? And are someone talking about it?
Yeah, there's discussions.
Yeah.
Of course. And you start to see little PDOs. So, we have a general PDO in terms of a wine rule system that we use.
The PDO is the wine rule system.
PDO is the protected designation of origin.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So like an appellation.
Appellation system.
Yeah. And we have one really for the whole of the UK industry in terms of quality English sparkling wine.
Yeah.
That's what it's called. And it has certain rules attached to it in terms of the grape varieties you can use. Lees aging is a minimum of 9 months, has to be bottle fermented. But there's not massive rules there.
No.
Which is great. It allows us to innovate. It allows us to create. And as a young industry, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
We're starting now to see...
Please remember to drink your wine, Laura.
We are
drinking at Burke now.
I will, yeah. Mm. It's never too early to drink Blanc de Blanc.
No, never.
So that's a good idea.
Just to mention that this podcast is recorded after 10 o'clock. Not 8 o'clock in the morning, but 10 is enough. Okay?
It's true, yeah.
But please continue.
We're starting to see, I think, there was recently the Sussex PDO that was launched. So that's a county.
Hmm.
It got a mixed reaction within the wine industry. But what it shows is that people are keen, I think, to find some kind of way to classify wines.
Yeah.
And whether that be geographically or whether that be from a lees aging perspective or a non-vintage versus vintage perspective or some way to do that. Or yes, I mean, I don't know. I don't think we're old enough yet as an industry.
But you're taking big steps because you have an organization who takes care of English sparkling. Yeah, you have open-minded people.
Yes.
You have expertise, and if you go back to champagne, they were farmers who didn't have expertise and didn't know what big champagne were going to be.
Yeah,
and today we see industry is by the big money. It's small producers, but in general, they are just it's a printing money machine. Champagne. Mm.
Champagne, yes.
Yeah,
sorry,
champagne,
meant,
but not English sparkling is still on the loan from the banks in certain cases. But it will come because the potential for when you have successes as in Norway, where a whole country is saying, this sparkling is fantastic. That's a good point of view. You have a lot of good tastings.
Yeah.
It will arrive. Imagine if English sparkling gets off in England. No, not in England. Maybe it's coming, but in Germany, in Portugal, in Spain, in other countries, because champagne is getting more expensive,
mm-hmm.
and the volume producer are making not so good, and you will use maybe 10 years to get a volume producer in, if you're going to have it.
Yeah,
because
for sure.
Because the price of land is going up in England now.
Mm-hmm.
People is you can't reach any, so it's the potential, I saw some numbers that it had been 10 double the price of land around areas where they already have. So it's starting to be mm-hmm. too expensive to invest. If not, you have investments like they do in other countries, like in Champagne, in Germany, and so on. You have other owners of the vineyards than the producers.
Right.
But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Gospen and are leading to, because I see this as leading star. How much time do you use to be, like, you're present in Norway now. It's an important market, of course.
Yeah.
But you're also present in tastings. You're present in information. I see you in letters. I see you intending to be a producer who is in front of the industry sometimes. You are
right.
On all the important wine fairs. You are present. And that's a goal to be?
Yeah, you know, our goal has always been to make world-class English sparkling wines.
Mm.
And yeah, gosh, you know, if that puts us in prominent tastings, and a lot of my role is both as a kind of a global presence in that respect, but also as kind of part of the blending team and part of other kind of support functions and that kind of thing. So yes, you know, I think it's wonderful to have these wines be tasted by yourself,
yeah.
by sommeliers and by consumers and people who are interested in these wines. And I think that's really, for us, it's about people hopefully understanding, you know, the passion that is behind these bottles, but the quality as well. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about the industry, and I think so rarely do we have the chance to witness a new region, especially a sparkling producer, from the ground up, and to see the potential, yeah. to see what's happening there. And I think that's where we are at the moment.
Mm.
And I'm really, really excited to be a part of it. So, yeah.
And Laura, we have to have a little introduction to our sponsor, and it will arrive now. And when we are coming back, I have to ask you some royalty question about the Queen who just passed away,
yep.
and how she was attending to the wine industry and how it is. But we will come back shortly after this commercial.
Selvfølgelig må vi bare takke Temtec igjen. Takk for at dere gjør denne podcasten her mulig. Hvis du på jakt etter et vinskap, og det burde man nesten alltid være, så sjekk ut Temtec sin Prestige-serie, en av toppseriene til Temtec. Bygg de inn, bygg de inn kjøkkenet, la de stå fritt for seg selv, store, små, forskjellige zoner, trehjuler, LED-belysning, juster temperatur, lys på egne paneler, luftfuktighet, label view hvis du har lyst til å se flaskene før du åpner kjøleskapet. Sjekk ut prestigeserien til Temptech, og tusen takk igjen ja, hos Power, selv Gunnars Power og takk igjen Temptech for at dere gjør podcasten her mulig.
And then we are back again, Laura. We have been discussing English sparkling for a while, and under the break of commercial we have talked a bit about the Queen, but also a little surprise for the Norwegian market. We
yes.
are earlier talking about Prestige Cuvée, who's coming,
yeah.
and it's coming to Norway next year.
Yeah, it's coming to Norway. So our Prestige Cuvée, we launched it just a couple of weeks ago
yeah.
in the UK.
And what is the highest point you have reached for that?
So it's called 51 Degrees North, vintage 2014.
Yes.
And it's going to be, you know, really the pinnacle, I think, of our yeah. winemaking.
And what will the cost be for a bottle in England?
Ooh,
for one moment.
In England, it's £195.
Only £195?
Yeah. £195.
Okay. And how big is the production?
It's small, a few thousand bottles.
Okay.
So
yeah, maybe it's coming 60 bottles to Norway.
Yeah, there will be some in Norway
yeah,
next year.
Okay, okay. That's going to be good.
Twist my arm, you might get
yeah.
more.
This is breaking news from England. It's this Prestige Cuvée coming up. I was looking for many years, and now it arrived, thank God. But back to the introduction to the royal family in England, because in many magazines I read that the English government, and especially the Queen and the family, was helping the industry. Because in the past, it was close relationship to the French, of course, Champagne and so on. But also, please tell me a little bit, gossip or not true or whatever, but what is in the base of the helping of the industry? Because in Norway, we have King, Queen, and help the Norwegian industry for Akvitt mm-hmm. and so on. But
yeah.
how have the English industry get help from the Queen Elizabeth when she was alive and the family?
So, you know, the royal family have been great supporters, I think, of farming generally in the UK. And I know that King Charles has always been very passionate about that with his duchy estate and that kind of thing. Queen Elizabeth, when she was on the throne, of course, would hold very many state dinners and banquets and hold official visits for people. And although often it was champagne that was being served, more and more in the last 10 or 15 years, they've been serving English sparkling wine at those events in Buckingham Palace. So I know that in 2012, at the it was the dinner for the pre-opening party of the Olympics. It's a very long way to explain it, sorry, at Buckingham Palace. And they served the Blanc de Blanc 2007 from Gusbourne. And they, I know that they've served other producers as well. So it's great. I think they own or have interests in their own vineyard areas as well. I think there's a lot of passion for English sparkling wine, which is great. And I know that King Charles and the Queen Consort as well have always been very passionate about English sparkling wine. So it'll be interesting to see what they do in the future too.
Because that's one of the reasons that you have officials who respect it, the industry. And Laura, we have to end this podcast. I think we're going to drink up the wine when this is over and have a little talk. But we will invite you to the podcast again, maybe in 10 years, when you're a grand old lady in the wine industry and see what happened. But we'll see you again when you're going to launch the Prestige Cuvée.
Perfect.
Because we need to taste that in Norway. We need to taste first. Cheers, Laura.
Cheers.
And I hope you see you. I will see you again.
Cheers. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ukens vindtips med Svein en Finansavisen podcast. Programleder Svein Lindin, produsent Lars Brenden Skram, og podcast- og videoansvarlig Marius Mørk Larsen. Ansvarlig redaktør Trygve Hegdar.